Okay. Give it a minute to let people take in that cheer. Yes, yes. I think we have time at the end. Maybe I'll try to end a few minutes early, and that way people can go get some coffee, whatever we need to do. Okay. Good morning, everyone. Thank you all so much for joining Beit Midrash Zichron Dov for this Israeli ER event. For those who don't know me, I am Rabbi Stephen Gottlieb. I'm one of the Avrichim in Beit Midrash Zichron Dov. I'm also assistant rabbi at the Village Shul. And for those former Ottawans in the house, I am the incoming director of the Glebe Shul in Ottawa. So lots of fun stuff going on. Thank you all so much for joining us this morning. This event's just an incredibly special showing all the different sides of Israel, going from Yom HaShoah into Yom HaZikaron into Yom HaAtzmaut and then into Yom Yerushalayim, and just showing all these facets of what it means to relate to Israel from all of these angles. And this particular shiur is dedicated by Robbie and Ryan Schwartz and family in honor of Israel's 75th birthday. So it's with that in mind that we go into talking about Yom HaAtzmaut through the lens of not only one approach to religious Zionism, but actually two approaches to religious Zionism. And those are the approaches of Rav Kook on one hand and Rav Soloveitchik on the other. Now, these two thinkers in some ways are very, very similar. In some ways are very different. Both of them are giants in the relevant yeshiva worlds, both in Israel and in North America. Both of them had the nickname The Rav. The old joke was that if you say the Rav in North America, you're talking about Rav Soloveitchik. If you say the Rav in Israel, you're talking about Rav Kook. And they actually did meet each other only once. They overlapped just barely. Rav Kook lived from 1865 to 1935. Rav Soloveitchik was from 1903 to 1993. And actually, Yehuda Mirsky writes about this in his intellectual biography of Rav Kook. When Rav Kook was nearing the end of his life, Rav Soloveitchik actually specifically went to visit him. They spoke. I understand it being written down mamish while Rav Kook was, like, near the end. And they spoke for a little bit. It's unclear what exactly was said, but whatever it was stuck with Rav Soloveitchik. Though, oddly, he only quotes Rav Kook, as far as I can tell, once in his writings, directly, in an essay called Shlichut. But what we're going to do today is not talk about that interaction, but actually talk about their particular unique approaches to the subject of religious Zionism. We'll look at Rav Soloveitchik's approach first, and then we'll look at Rav Kook's, and we'll see if by the end of it we can draw a line between the approaches and see if we can have continuity between the two, or if we have to have these two approaches as separate. But hopefully there's a lot to complement each other and a lot to learn. I do want to say, and I open all of my shiurim with this, so those who have been to shiurim of mine before know this, the sources on these sheets are here to keep me honest. I'm not going to be quoting all of them inside. I'll be quoting a few of them from inside, but for the most part, I want this to really be a discussion. So with that having been said, let's start to talk about Rav Soloveitchik. So if I say the name Rav Soloveitchik, what's a word or two that comes to mind? And anyone can just say, what word comes to mind if I say Rav Soloveitchik? What's an association? Going once. Scholar, so that's certainly one. He had a PhD. He was very involved in the world of philosophy and the world of halakha. Certainly very scholarly. People like to say his favorite word was dialectic. And you'll get a brownie point if you can tell me what the word dialectic means. But putting different thoughts in conversation with each other. And
favorite word is antinomian.
Yes, antinomian also. The antinomian tension is very present in Rav Soloveitchik's writings. Ah, so yes. So Rav Soloveitchik famously started in the Aguda movement and transitioned to the Mizrahi movement, which is the religious Zionist movement. That was a big move. It caused a lot of problems with his relationships with many of his family members, many of those he had been friends with. Another point of interest, by the way, that unites Rav Kook and Rav Soloveitchik is that both of them learned in similar yeshiva styles, the style of the Volozhin Brisker Yeshiva, but both also had Hasidic roots. In the case of Rav Kook, he came from a Hasidic family going back on one side. In the case of Rav Soloveitchik, he had a Chabad Hasid as a tutor privately. The story goes that that tutor was actually fired because Rav Soloveitchik's father found out he was learning more Tanya than Gemara. But both of them, in many ways, unite these two approaches. Rav Soloveitchik's approach to Zionism is most spelled out, and Rabbi Toshiner is going to show a different approach to this after this, so you'll get a few different modes. But his approach is most directly spelled out in now a book called Kol Dodi Do Fake. It was originally given as a speech he gave at Yeshiva University in 1956. And what's interesting about this speech is that it doesn't start directly with the question of Zionism. It actually starts with the question of how do we respond to the tragedy of the Holocaust? And in fact, how do Jews historically respond to tragedy in general? Rav Inan talked about this a little bit in his shiur. And Rav Soloveitchik answered the question by saying, it's not our place to ask, why did this happen? Hashem has his reasons. Those reasons are his own. Our place is to ask, how do we respond to this in a way that is productive and that will lead in a positive direction moving forward? This is, in fact, an underlying theme in Rav Soloveitchik's writing in general. We don't often ask the underlying theological premises behind things. We ask, what are we supposed to do in the moment? In fact, in an essay that Rav Soloveitchik wrote called The Halachic Mind, easily his most philosophically dense essay that's put out for a general audience. I wouldn't even say it was put out for a general audience, though it is available. So he actually asks the question, how do we learn what Jewish theology, hashkafa, Jewish philosophy is? And he says, you learn it from halacha first. If you learn halacha properly, then the underlying ideas will be evident in how the halacha comes out. So you start with the what, and that will lead to a why through it. But we don't spend the time really thinking about the philosophical, theological reasons, because that's ultimately in Hashem's mind, not in ours. So he says the question is not necessarily, why did the Holocaust happen? But how do we respond to it? And he said the way to respond to it is by listening to the historical moment that has since come. He uses an analogy based on the Song of Songs, which is an allegory for the Jewish people's relationship to Hashem. You have two lovers pining for each other, one going after the other, knocks at the door, and the tragic missing of the knock. They don't get out of bed in time, and they are unable to greet the lover. And Rav Soloveitchik uses that as an opportunity to really show what it means to respond. And Rav Soloveitchik says there are six knocks that we can hear in history from the state of Israel. And the question is, are we going to open that door? So I'll just run through them very, very quickly. I listed them on the search for those who want to fact check. But for those who don't, I'll talk about them each individually. Number one is the knock of politics. That so many countries came together to say, we want the Jews to have the state of Israel. Not only the U.S. and the USSR, but all of these people coming together. In fact, Rav Soloveitchik says explicitly, in his mind, the only reason that the United Nations was created was to give us the state of Israel, because they haven't done anything else useful otherwise. You can judge if that's correct for yourself, but he does hint at that. So that's the knock of politics. Number two is the knock heard on the battlefield. The War of Independence was won. So many enemies coming and attacking from so many different angles. We were able to overcome and succeed. And that's an unbelievable moment. Knock number three is the knock of theology. Not necessarily Jewish theology, but the knock against Christian theology. Christians largely believed that the Jews being spread out and in exile and away from Israel was a proof that they were correct, that God didn't want the Jewish people to be in our homeland anymore, that God had a new covenant, and that was that. But the Jews suddenly being back in our homeland and making it thrive, he says, should give everyone who believed that pause. They see not only that the Jewish people deserve their land, but that Hashem is working to bring the Jewish people back to that land, that so many miracles are happening to lead the Jewish people back to that homeland, and that's something to recognize. Knock number four is the knock in the heart of the assimilated youth. That there were so many people at the time, so many young people who were going away from Judaism, moving towards more secular approaches, but now suddenly they have something to be proud of. They have something to see. They recognize that there is something greater calling to them. And in that, really, Zionism, they are finding a Jewish identity to be proud of, and that attracts them back into the Jewish world. Knock number five, Rav Soloveitchik says, might be the most important, and that is the discovery that Jewish blood is not cheap, that Jews won't just sit down and be killed, that if you attack us, we will fight back and we will win. And that's something that really was not a given at that point in time. And knock number six, finally, the last one they said we hear, is the knock heard by opening the gates to the land of Israel. That for the first time, the Jewish people had somewhere that we could go to in a time of need. That when the governments around us turn on us, when things get dark, we have somewhere that we can go to, somewhere we know we can always call home, no matter where we are, no matter how far away we are, and that we can go back to and find salvation in. And Rav Soloveitchik says these six knocks at the door, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, are things that we should all pay attention to and hear. And the question is, do we recognize them? And are we able to open the door in time? Are we able to embrace that? If we do, Rav Soloveitchik says, that is the key of turning fate into destiny. In Rav Soloveitchik, he talks about two covenants of the Jewish people. There's a covenant of fate. That's a covenant of Egypt. The Jewish people were all together in Egypt. We all faced the same labor. We all faced anti-Semitism together. That's fate. You know, we're all in this together. No matter how Jewish I look, there's going to be anti-Semitism. There's going to be someone who hears the last name Gottlieb and, you know, tosses a penny, whatever it may be, or a loony, as the case may be. And it's just going to happen. That's regardless of what we're doing actively. But then there's the covenant of destiny, the covenant at Har Sinai. And that's when the Jewish people say that we have a identity and we are moving actively towards it. Rav Soloveitchik says the job of the Jew is to turn fate into destiny. Not to passively take what's at us, but to actively move forward with a proud Jewish identity and a proud sense of what it means to be a Jew in the world. And so the question is, are we listening to those knocks? And if we are, how do we answer it? Because Rav Soloveitchik says, look, so far meaning the 8 years between Israel becoming a state and him giving this address, but I think it's still appropriate in many ways. So he says, so far, it hasn't really been that great for us. You know, we like to complain about the sidelines. Oh, Israel did this wrong. Israel did that wrong. Israel should be doing this with their money. Should be doing that with their money. These conversations happen at, I'm sure, everyone's Shabbos table at least once or twice. And he says, we like to really comment on this. We like to be, backseat drivers when it comes to this. But how often do we actually put our money where our mouth is? You know, what would it look like if we meaning the extended Orthodox community, actually put effort into extending influence and getting something done, into actually shaping the spiritual character of the land of Israel? And here he was responding specifically to people who thought that Israel as a country was too secular. He said, if you really want Israel to be a better country for religious people, you as a religious Jew need to actually do something about it. It's not a question of just thinking about, oh, what they might be able to do better. It's a question of donating to organizations, helping, making aliyah if you're inclined to do that, going to Israel and actually being part of this in a serious way. He says we should shape the character of the land. And we should be hurried to awaken from our slumber, because right now, if you're not doing anything, it means you're still asleep. You might hear the knock at the door. If you haven't got out of bed, you haven't gotten dressed, you haven't prepared yourself to open the door, what are you doing? And the answer is ultimately nothing, because you're going to miss the door, you're going to miss the opportunity, and even if you open the door at that point, the guest is long gone. And he says, our job as Jews should be to facilitate the establishment of more, for example, religious kibbutzim, to build more housing for religious immigrants, to be able to have places, to be able to establish a system of religious schools, and to be able to give to that. He says the greatest sin of the Orthodox community in the diaspora, and this I think has changed to a degree, is that compared to other denominations of Judaism, at the time Rav Soloveitchik was talking about this, the Orthodox community was actually not giving so much money by comparison to these kinds of causes. Now, I would need to actually look at the numbers and see what they were, but Rav Soloveitchik said this with a degree of confidence. And he says quite literally, we need to put our money where our mouth is and actually do something about this. We need to actually wake ourselves up, get out of bed, and not only listen to the knocks, but open the door and greet who is there, or we will miss the opportunity. For Soloveitchik, it was not a given that things were going to keep going well. It required the work of each and every Jew to turn that fate into destiny and as such actively help support the destiny of the state of Israel. So for Soloveitchik, this Zionism is really all about the action that we are putting into this, recognizing this moment in history where God is right there, right in front of us, saying, come here, saying, help support this. And if we're listening, we'll be able to foster that. But if we're not, it's a big problem. And he says, and here I'll just quote this last paragraph. It's very helpful. Do not hear in our trembling over the safety and tranquility of the land of Israel in our day the beckoning of the, sorry, do we not hear in our trembling over the safety and tranquility of the land of Israel in our day the beckoning of the beloved who begs the lover to let him in? He has already been beckoning for 8 years, and still he has not been properly responded to. Nonetheless, he continues to beckon, right? The state of Israel is still growing, still moving in that direction. To our good fortune, our inherited land has become more beautiful. The beloved has not shown the lover any favoritism, but he has compassion for her. The beloved beckoned for only a short moment that night and disappeared. Yet with us, he has exhibited extraordinary patience. He's still there. He's still knocking. We need to hear that. It's 8 years that he's continued to beckon. Hopefully we will not miss this opportunity. What was true then is still true now. We still see this. We still see these moments to actually do something, to actually not just listen, but to respond to that call, to hear it and to do, quite literally, na'aseh and nishma. And if we are able to, then we're able to help foster the destiny not only of ourselves, but of the entire Jewish people. But for Rav Soloveitchik, the core of this Zionism is that it is in this response. It's not necessarily in the underlying theology. It's not necessarily in the underlying approach. It is fundamentally, how do we respond to what we hear in a way that will move us forward and that will continue the Jewish people's destiny? Now, before we switch to Rav Cook, does anyone have any questions on the Rav Soloveitchik end? Yes.
It's difficult to ask this question, but I have to ask it. He makes the case, and he never wrote it. How do we understand that? I mean, how do we hear someone lecture, right, you know, and tell us this is what you need to do when you're coming across in a very, very erudite fashion, and, mm-hmm, you know, but Tachlis, I mean, this was written in 56. He never went.
Yeah, so it's a really, really good question. I do need to say, if I answered that question now, I wouldn't have time to discuss Rav Cook.
I didn't want to ask,
but yeah, Rabbi Tuchiner?
Yeah, taking it away from, but just Rabbi Soloveitchik addressed this in a letter. He was a teacher who sent him a letter asking, so why aren't you there? Unlike the Kuzarizians of the Gabi, he said he felt that his role was to be a teacher and that he had students at the university, and that was his job.
There we go. Right. It's a good point. And we can add that to the many dialectics of Rav Soloveitchik. You know, he was really a man of many, many tensions. I think that's one of them. So now let's talk a little bit about Rav Cook. And so I'll ask the same question as Rav Soloveitchik. If I say the name Rav Cook, what's a word or two that comes to mind? Besides Zionism, that's an easy one. Anything?
Love of Jews.
That's a really great one. Zionist, yeah. Secular people fulfilling God's work. Yeah, all of these are really important in Rav Cook's writing, and I want to actually get on that. For Rav Cook, the underlying approach is what we can call an approach of unity, not dialectical tension, not compartmentalization. For Rav Cook, and this is something that actually all scholars that I've read on Rav Cook agree, whether they're Orthodox or secular Zionists, that if you look at Rav Cook's philosophy, there is an underlying sense that everything is united, everything has holiness within it. It's just a matter of being able to bring it out in the best way. Now, there is tension in how we reconcile his written philosophy with his halachic positions. There are many that don't seem to quite align. That's not what we're talking about right now. I just want to throw that out there. But really, Rav Cook's perspective is underlying everything is this sense of unity. However, in practice, we do not live in a world where that is possible. Source number four, these are actually out of order on the sheet, I apologize, I put this together in a hurry. Source number four on my sheet goes into that. That at the end of the day, this viewpoint of unity is fundamentally hidden. It comes out over time by these two sides interacting with each other, by seeing things play out in history. But that underlying real sense is very much behind the scenes. It's not explicit, and that is by design. That is actually part of what it means to be human, is to recognize that this truth is not easily accessible to us, and that we are still in a position where we are actually morally obligated to still pick a side, still be doing what we are doing, and respond to it in good faith. Now, ultimately, there will be illumination. There will be light coming and shed on it over time. In the Messianic era, we will be in that complete, unabashed unity. But until then, we need to struggle with that. And how do we go about that struggle? How do we navigate that? So Rav Kook says that the Jewish people are actually in the easy position to navigate with that because we have the Torah. That's source number two on this sheet. Again, I apologize, these are out of order. Not even in reverse order, just mamish out of order. But so source number two is talking about how the Jewish people are actually, in many ways, a receptacle of this unity, that we all have a sense deep down that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem, is underlying everything and is there, and everything has holiness waiting to be brought out. But we need a sense of direction to go in so that we know how to bring things out in the best, most productive way. And the Torah acts as that guidepost for us, acts as a map that we can use by which to navigate that. He says, the encompassing spiritual inner revelation in the depths of the Jewish soul sets before us the inner form of all the practical Torah. We all have that in us. There's actually mystical teachings that say that the Torah is the blueprint of human beings as well. And this contains all the Torah's practical details. The entire sweep of the oral Torah, through everything, flows from a supernal source and unites in a solid element. That is the element of the Jew fulfilling it. And we are then able to get in a more uplifting perspective. We increasingly rise. We move higher and higher. And as we do, that underlying unity will become clearer. As we fulfill more mitzvot, as we bring the Torah's promises into fruition, we are revealing more of that not only to ourselves, but to the world as a whole. And he says, ultimately, all this is in accordance with our diligence in learning Torah, performing good deeds, and elevating our character, and the illumination that comes from clinging to God in a spirit of supernal consciousness. So the point of Torah is to align ourselves, align our consciousness with that divine unity, and follow the Torah through to bring that out and literally act as a light onto all of the nations as well. Now, the question is there an ideal way or place to do that or not? And for Rav Kook, the answer is unabashedly, yes, there is. And that answer is in the land of Israel. Remember, this is before the official state of Israel, but the land of Israel itself. Rav Kook says, and this is in source number three here, that in the land of Israel, it's possible to draw the joy of holiness from the sight of joy itself. Now, joy here is the word simcha in Hebrew. This is a true sense of happiness, completeness, unity, all of that. Outside the land, however, it is impossible to draw down this joy because of the opposition and wrath of the powers of judgment outside the land. That means both in a mystical sense, there's heavenly bodies conspiring against it, but also in the practical sense. We're distracted here. We're not in a country where we can really be ourselves. We're not in a land where we can have rule of halakha, where we're able to engage in the Torah in a true way. And as a result of that, things are more, quite literally, shady, foggy. It's unclear. We can draw down this joy only by drawing it from the source of delight, where neither obstacle nor damage reach. And this is why, in consequence of the destruction of the temple, joy is halakhically forbidden, right? There are points in the Talmud where it says, simcha, happiness, cannot be felt after the temple was destroyed. But he said there are also things called delight, in Hebrew, oneg, that are allowed. We can still have certain senses of enjoyment, but it's not true happiness. The way Rav Kook talks about this elsewhere in Orot HaKodesh is that simcha, true happiness, is the root of yira. The root of awe. We often translate yira as fear. It's really awe. Being in awe of something bigger than ourselves, being part of something infinitely larger and more meaningful than we can be as an individual. And that stems from happiness. That true sense of happiness, simcha, is the root of it. Oneg is the root of anava, of humility. You can be a humble person. You can be a person who's able to find enjoyment. But to have true yira, to have true uninterrupted sense of this is what I know I am meant to do and I am at peace with something larger than myself, that, he says, takes true simcha. And true simcha can only be reached when we are living as Jews in a Jewish nation, uninterrupted and unbothered by what is around us. He says that's why joy is forbidden outside of the land. When we delight in love from the delights of the source of holiness, there descends a pure joy, enriched with delight, right? These two come together, they complement each other, which draws the atmosphere of the land of Israel to some degree outside the land, to revive the spirit of those who hope for the mercies of God, who yearn to see it and rejoice in its joy. When we see Israel flourishing again, when we see the religious Zionist community being a Kiddush Hashem, that light will spread to us and will help us here, but still for us to truly be part of that for Rav Kook will require being in the land. And that will require a period of chaos in the beginning. Secular Zionism for him was an expression of that. But it will ultimately lead to a time of tikkun, of rectification, when we are brought back to that whole state and the unity of everything is made clear through the light that emanates from Israel and comes outside through it. For Rav Kook, this is a true fulfillment of the famous phrase, Ivdu es Hashem besimcha, that you served you with happiness, joy in the true sense, not in the diluted sense. He says we can have a sense of diluted joy here that is complemented by what we see in Israel, but Israel is the center. Israel is where it is coming from. Now, how do we unite this, if at all, with Rav Soloveitchik's perspective? So you can say in an easy way that Rav Kook had the theological aspect down, and Rav Soloveitchik had the practical aspect. That at the end of the day, Rav Kook's approach can serve to underlie the approach of Rav Soloveitchik in that regard, and the two come together. In fact, when we see those knocks, we need to ask ourselves, where is that knocking from? That's an unanswered question. It's because in many ways it's obvious. Yeah, it's coming from Hashem, obviously. But the mechanism by which that happens is that underlying everything is that sense of holiness. Underlying all of this, moving forward, is now this chance for the divine to knock on the door and get us to try to respond. And if we are responding, then in that active response, we're fulfilling Rav Kook's idea. We're bringing that unity closer. If we don't, we're remaining more differentiated, more apart. So we have these two ideas in Zionism. Many people treat as completely separate because they don't put in conversation with each other, but really tremendously complement each other and give what I want to argue is a complete picture of not only a practical Zionism, but a theological Zionism as well. Now, this did not address the question of Lamasa, in practice, what do we do as Jews who are living outside of the state of Israel? You know, an easy answer would be, say, make Aliyah. Another easy answer would be, say, to support the state of Israel as much as we can. I don't have time to get into that right now. It's literally 11:30 on the dot. But for a hypothetical part two or to discuss afterwards, we can keep those questions in mind.
If you want to take some refreshments, or say, running